And welcome to this week's edition of An Organic Conversation, a show about food, ecology, stories from the land, relationships, and life itself. We're your hosts, Helge Hellberg.
And Mark Mulcahy.
And we're excited about the show today, packed full with information and celebration. We have a great guest today here with us in the studio, a national leader in sustainable agriculture and food systems, Oren Hesterman, the president and CEO of the Fair Food Network, here today with his brand new book, Fair Food. And Mark, more than that, the season is happening.
It's warm weather and the fruit is popping.
It's popping, finally.
It's popping. It's showing up in the stores and it's tasting the way it should. And coming up today, we're going to talk about a delectable summer fruit that is the second most cultivated fruit in the world.
Second most.
What do you think is the first?
Is it a tropical or is it a...
What do you think is the first?
Apples.
There you go.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Apples are the first. And we'll find out what's number two. But first, we're going to go to the green headlines with Gina Rastani.
Thank you, Mark. First, it's news here at home. Genetically modified salmon will most likely not go on sale in the U.S. The House of Representatives has approved a law that would prohibit the FDA from approving genetically modified fish for human consumption. The debate will continue on the Senate floor in the coming weeks, so stay tuned for that. The Senate has introduced a bill to limit the use of antibiotics in livestock in an effort to combat human resistance to certain drugs. The bill will limit the agricultural use of 7 types of antibiotics that have been identified by the FDA as critically important to human medicine. Google has plans to spend $280 million to give you solar panels for free. The Google investment is enough to put solar panels on 9,000 homes, which would mean that one in every 10 solar installations in the U.S. would potentially be Google-sponsored. Honduras has taken a step in boosting its 2010 moratorium on shark fishing with an announcement that the country is creating a 92,000-square-mile shark sanctuary in its waters. This news comes just a few months after Indonesia set aside over 17,000 square miles as a shark sanctuary. In sports, the NHL is attempting to offset their water consumption by purchasing so-called water certificates. It's estimated that a 7-game playoff series consumes roughly 800,000 gallons of water, from resurfacing the ice to concessions to flushing toilets. And in frog news, a Las Vegas native thought to have been extinct for over 60 years is alive and living in Arizona. The Vegas Valley leopard frog was last seen in 1942 and officially declared extinct in 1996. I'm Gina Rastani, and that was this week's Green Headlines. Helga?
Thank you, Gina. An old Las Vegas native. That is hopeful news. It's fascinating to me. We are losing so many species literally every day, and yet we also find new ones every day. And then we find those ones that we thought were extinct but have come back. I mean, where was this guy hiding?
You know what? I think if it was from Las Vegas, it might have been a witness protection.
Yeah, or he was hiding in a casino or something. But anyway, the leopard frog, the Las Vegas Valley leopard frog, is back. We don't know how big it is, but there will be a picture on our Facebook page, An Organic Conversation Facebook. Check it out. I think it's huge.
And if it's been in Las Vegas and in Arizona, it's probably tan. It's probably ready to come back into the world.
Well, it's leopard. The name must come from somewhere. It must have the size of a leopard. Find out more. An Organic Conversation on Facebook. Thanks again, Gina. Wonderful. Hopeful news. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we'll be back. We'll take a quick break. Stay tuned for the interview with food system expert Oren Hesterman, live with us in the studio today, talking about what's broken about the current food system and, even more importantly, how we can heal it. So excited to have you here, Oren. Thanks for coming to the studio. All of that and more when we come back right after the break.
Holding out, she knows what I'm about. I start to play the silent card. You make this easy, or you play me like a shark. Arms holding nose to the floor, it's got to be a leap of faith. I wish somebody pushed me that way. I know who to blame when we go out tonight. I'll be looking so far past the flashing light.
Finally open my arms wide. Finally I let
And we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today we are talking about healing the food system. We have a fantastic guest, Dr. Oren Hesterman, who just released his brand new book, Fair Food, coming in from Ann Arbor, Michigan today, joining us in the studio. Thank you, Oren, for being part of it. This is awesome.
It's my pleasure to be here, Helge.
We play different roles in the food systems. Whatever we do, you know, some of us listening are produce managers, we might be chefs, we might be gardeners, hobby gardeners, but there's one thing we all do, which is eat. And as eaters, we are engaged in the food system, whether we like it or we realize it or acknowledge it or not. And our choices daily with the fork define how this food system works. And so it's a pleasure, Oren, to have you here today and talk about how we can become engaged food system participants.
Yeah. Yeah, Oren, so your book, Fair Food, talks about a broken food system. Can you tell us what this looks like?
Well, you know, whether we look at environmental issues like a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, now about the size of the state of Massachusetts, whether we look at the way our farm and food workers are treated, many times deplorable conditions, living conditions, very low wages, or whether we look at the issues of childhood obesity and diet-related illness, in every direction we look, rather than looking at these each as individual problems to be solved, I look at these as symptoms of a food system that is broken and out of control. You know, I started looking at this, Mark, much differently when I was about age 36 and found myself in the hospital. Had a very serious disease, ulcerative colitis. My digestive system had basically stopped functioning. The doc said, it doesn't get better by the end of the week and my only option is surgery. Live the rest of my life without a colon. When I could finally eat a little something a couple days later, what comes to my tray at the bedside? Roast beef, a pile of mashed potatoes, and some big piece of cake made out of white sugar, white flour. And I say, I know this is not what I need to get myself better. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, I had a friend who could bring me some food in the hospital.
And fortunately, you knew that that was not the diet.
Exactly.
Because most people would eat it.
I was fortunate because I knew what I needed to eat and I had access to it. But lying there in bed, that hospital bed that week, I started thinking about all the people who don't, who either don't have the knowledge and education, or if they do, they simply don't have the access. And, you know, I live in Ann Arbor. My organization, Fair Food Network, does a lot of work in Detroit now. Mm-hmm. And in Detroit, you have about 500,000 people that live in areas where their access to fresh fruits and vegetables is basically nil. Unless they are able to drive out to the suburbs or find one of the few farmers markets, they are living life, purchasing their food in liquor stores, convenience stores, and places where they simply can't access the food they need to stay healthy.
And 500,000 people. Now, how many times is that replicated in large cities around the country?
Just about everywhere you go. I mean, any large inner city in this country, you are going to find populations that are living in what USDA has termed food deserts. Now, I'm not particularly enamored of that term, but that is a term that's being used now, and it does describe an area where access to fast food restaurants, access to marginal food outlets is much easier than access to anything resembling a full-service store or somewhere where people can buy the healthy food they need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or maybe we should come up with a new term, actually, like food deprived or something, because the desert is actually a beautiful thing. But
is a lot of life there.
But you're making an excellent point, Oren. Food and the way we produce food and the way we offer food and process food literally touches on all these issues that you just mentioned: environmental health, personal health, farm worker health, local economies. Local communities, everything is really from the ground up affected by how we treat the soil, and then from there, what we do with the food and how it's being distributed.
Right, and the bad news is when we are not in the right relationship with our food system and the right relationship with our earth that provides us our nourishment, things can get bad quickly. The good news is that by focusing on getting that relationship right with our food system, to create a system that's healthy for our kids, healthy for our environment, healthy for our communities, we can actually see a great healing happen as well.
So, and we'll talk about that in this show to a great extent, because it is, the show is all about the language of possibility and healing, what can be healed. But how did we get here? This didn't happen overnight. We have, you know, for the last 30, 40 years created the system that we are now needing to heal. Why did it have come this far?
And I think, Helga, it's even longer than 30 or 40 years.
Tell us about it.
We have a food system in place right now that, if you looked at some of the public policies that we put into place in the United States, really post-Depression and during the Dust Bowl years, now, they were policies that made a lot of sense then. We needed more food for less money. We needed farmers to become more productive for a growing population, and it was at a time in this country when we were rapidly urbanizing, fewer people in rural communities. We needed the higher production, and we had lots of research that we could start implementing in terms of technology and so forth. The problem we have is that the policies we have in place today are largely the same as we put in place in the 1930s, but our context has completely shifted. We need to update the policies that drive our system in order to update our system.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helga Helberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And with us in the studio from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is food systems expert Dr. Oren Hesterman, the CEO and president of the Fair Food Network, here with his brand new book, Fair Food. Talk more about the policy, Oren. When we look 50 years back, we already acknowledge with the Dust Bowl that our relationship to soil had begun to decay. It was not working. Why did it take us 50 years to now? I mean, the food movement is growing everywhere across the country. Finally, we have, you know, as what started as a grassroots movement in the late 70s has now presidential oversight in a way with Michelle Obama's obese campaign, because the issues with our relationship to food and soil are no longer deniable. It's in our face. You had an amazing event a couple nights ago, and you were saying if we continue this road, the cost of obesity alone will be somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 billion.
Right. So this came from a conversation that I was in with the executive vice president of the largest health insurance company in the United States. He says, you know, we've looked at trends, we've run the numbers, and if current trends continue, by the year 2018, the cost of treating obesity-related illness in the United States will be $345 billion a year.
2018?
Yes, that's coming quickly.
That's in 7 years.
It blew me away when he said this. But he says, I mean, this is a company that looks at its numbers. We've run the numbers. He says when that happens, it not only bankrupts our company, it bankrupts this country. Because if you think about it, when the cost of treating obesity-related illness is that high, I'm not sure how many of us can afford health insurance. And the burden on all of us to pay for health care for those who don't have insurance is more than we can bear. And all that happens out there in a few years because we're not doing enough today to shift our food system, to create food environments where everybody has access to the healthy food they need.
And you were talking about policies from the 30s. And then I also recall that, like, in the 70s, there was some policy shifts where, you know, get bigger farms to get bigger to produce more commodities and things like that. And that is part of the same system that helped to create this obesity crisis, is because it was sugar and corn and soybeans and a lot of commodities that were used, like corn syrup and things like that, that became a normal part of the American diet, right? Because even the food manufacturers actually started producing more and more products out of less and less diversity.
Well, one of the challenges we have, I mean, it made sense back in the 30s to actually incentivize farmers to become more efficient and to grow the crops we needed for a growing agriculture. Mm-hmm. The problem is when you create an incentive like that, you're actually creating a interest group, because money is now flowing
right
to certain commodity organizations. And those organizations now have huge power mm-hmm. in terms of our agriculture policy. You know, I don't believe we really need to be incentivizing the production of corn and soybeans, the two crops that are grown on nearly 50% of all cultivated acreage mm-hmm. in this country. what we need for a healthy food system for the future is more diversity. We know agronomically we need more diversity, socially and economically we need more diversity for a more resilient system. You do that by creating policies that incentivize that diverse production.
And we'll dive into that much, much more when we come back to our interview with Dr. Oren Hesterman, the president of the Fair Food Network, and here today from Ann Arbor, Michigan, with his brand new book, Fair Food. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we'll talk about food system and how to heal our existing food system when we come back. And also, Mark Mulcahy with What's in Season. All that and more right after the break. Stay tuned.
My name is Earl Herrick, and I am the owner of Earl's Organic Produce, a San Francisco Bay Area distributor fully committed to organic produce. From the time one could find organic fruits and vegetables only in natural food stores to now, when schools and fine restaurants feature organic, we have been forging relationships with growers for over 20 years. If you want to offer the finest organic produce to your employees or customers, find us at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Fry Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Sungevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Sungevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Do you feel run down, stressed, overweight, or overloaded? Urban Remedy is a delicious 100% organic juice cleansing program designed to jumpstart your body's natural healing and cleansing abilities. This delicious juice feast, created by leading acupuncturist Nika Pasquale, is rich in vital nutrients, minerals, and enzymes, providing you with all the nutritional nourishment you need to thrive. Delivered directly to your doorstep. Urban Remedy, a convenient way to boost your energy and balance your body. Place your order today at urbanremedy.com. That's urbanremedy.com.
Over 25 years ago, my husband and I started a business around our passion for ginger. We called it the Ginger People. Today, you can find our products at natural food stores nationwide. We love ginger. It's what we do. And the more we learned about the amazing properties of ginger, the more we realized that everyone benefits from eating ginger every day. My name is Abby Leeson, and I am with the Ginger People. To learn more about our products, the goodness of ginger, and how it can improve your health, visit gingerpeople.com. That's gingerpeople.com.
And we are back here to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we are talking with Oren Hesterman today about his new book, Fair Food, and How to Heal the Current Food System. And we'll learn more about the actions we can take, because we all do play a role in this food system. Whatever we actively do, there's one thing we all do, which is eat every day several times. And we can vote with our fork. And as Dr. Hesterman says, there's so much more we can do, we can easily do, to be more engaged citizens. All that in a minute. But first, here's Mark Mulcahy with What's in Season.
Thank you for that drum roll. That's amazing. So at the beginning of the show, I was mentioning that we were going to talk about the second most cultivated fruit in the world.
First being apples.
And what surprised me is that the second most cultivated fruit in the world is a tree that Oren has in his backyard, and that is plums. I would have never thought that.
No, me neither.
I would have never thought that, but they're grown all over China and over several parts of Europe, all over the world. And so very exciting. And right now, they're great. And the interesting thing is, you know, we go into the store and you see, what do you see? Maybe two, three types of plums when you're in the store. You know, I would imagine, yeah, I don't know how much, if you go to the farmer's market, you might see 10. There are thousands of varieties of plums out there that are available all over the world. And they all are great and they're all unique. They go from anywhere from sweet tart to very sweet to just juicy, drippy, succulent, where you just eat so many that you have to run into the house. But anyway,
Get paper towels.
To get paper towels, yes. Yeah. And they can be green, red, purple, black. I mean, just all kinds of colors. So when you get to the farmer's market or you get to the store, how do you pick them out? Well, plums should be plump, smooth skinned, and well colored. There shouldn't be any spotting or they shouldn't look dull at all. So you want to make sure that that's what you look for. Another thing that you may have noticed when you pick out plums at the market is that sometimes when they're picked mature and ripe, you'll see like kind of a white coating on the outside. And that's known as bloom. And it's a waxy substance that is easily rubbed off, so you don't have to worry about it. But it's a natural repellent for the fruit that actually helps to repel water, so light rain in the summer, and also helps to repel some insects. But it's completely natural, and you don't have to worry about it, but you just rub it off and then take a big old bite of that. So once you got them home, you want to store them at room temperature. And now this is the interesting part, because my house in the summertime is about 80 or 90 degrees some days, right? Room temperature, they're saying between 50 and 75 degrees is room temperature. So if it's not, you want to try to find the coolest spot in the house to get the most life out of them. And when are they ready? They're ready when they give off a sweet plum aroma and are soft to the touch. But here's the important thing that you may not have known. You don't want to eat them cold. You want to pull them out of the fridge so they get to be room temperature. And that's how you get your most satisfying flavor, because when it comes to room temperature, it's natural sugars, you know, come into the fruit and you just get the most amazing experience. And that's when you'll close your eyes as you're biting this thing and just get sheer joy from that plum you chose. So lastly, if you want to ripen your plums at home a little faster, we talked a few weeks ago about ripening fruit in a brown bag, right? That'll help ripen them faster. If they ripen too quick, you can put them in the fridge in a plastic bag and they'll hold up for about 4 days. But one thing you want to remember is never put it in a bag with other fruit once it's already ripe, because the ethylene gas will continue to ripen it. So that's your what's in season for the day. But if you're thinking, well, Mark, there's no recipes, you didn't tell us any more about the fruit, that's coming up. Chef Sita is going to be coming up with the holistic bite in just a few minutes to tell you what you can do with these. So stay tuned.
Thank you, Mark. This week's what's in season on plums. That's great. I remember in Germany, we have these kind of chicken egg shaped plums mm-hmm. that I have completely forgotten about. Mm-hmm. And your segment just brought that back. To me, yes, I'm going to look for those. Do you know what those might be?
Well, they're like a prune plum or a French plum.
Chicken, yeah, very, very rich, juicy.
That's a European plum. Most of the plums that we're seeing, the rounder ones that we see.
Makes sense. Well, since it's from Germany.
But well, I have no idea. But most of the rounder ones that you're seeing in this country are actually Japanese plums. So the rounder ones that you see at the market are Japanese, and the small, elongated, egg-shaped, as Helga would call them, are prune plums or European plums, and those are later in the season.
Man, your brain for 1 minute. Oh, this would be a good life. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helga Helberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
Produce expert Mark Mulcahy. And today we're talking about healing the food system. With us in the studio all the way from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is the president of the Fair Food Network, President and CEO Dr. Oren Hesterman, with his brand new book, still hot off the press, Fair Food. Oren, thanks again for joining us. And we talked about what's broken about the food system, that the way we grow food and the way we eat and distribute food, the way we prepare food and process food, affects literally all parts of our society, from shipping it, from growing it, from the natural environments to waterways, to personal health, to obesity issues. You had a staggering number, according to the largest insurance company right before the break. If we continue on this path, the cost of obesity alone will be somewhere in the neighborhood of $350 billion, which simply we cannot afford.
Right.
Literally, we cannot afford. Metaphorically and literally, we cannot afford as an insurance company and as a society. And of course, the 350 billion stands for millions and millions of children being obese and adults in this country already. What can we do? How did we get to this point we talked about in the first part of the interview? My question that I still had out of that was, this did not happen overnight. You touched on policies a little bit, but let's dive in for just one more second. We have known this for the last 30 years, and now there's a rising awareness around these issues because they're completely in our faces. But why does it take 30 years to change the course that we were on?
You know, the when policies get created that bring resource flows to certain segments, certain sectors, and certain individuals, it's difficult to change those resource flows. So, for example, the Farm Bill, the omnibus piece of legislation at the federal level that really directs resource flows and regulations around agriculture in this country, has really been controlled by rural and large agricultural interests for many years. And as long as it stays like that, our policies will look like they do now. We need to understand, I'm assuming many of our listeners are not farmers. Many of our listeners are
eaters.
They're eaters. They are people who live in suburban or urban communities who may not realize that a farm bill, while it sounds like it's only for farmers, it is for them. And if we are going to change these policies so we create a healthy system for the future, they need to get engaged. People who have not thought about engaging in farm or farm bill policy, they need to start getting engaged, because one way we're going to change the system is by each of us voting with our forks. Another way we're going to change it is by shifting our public policies.
And you're one of the leaders of sustainable food systems that says we should maybe rename it into a food bill, right, rather than a farm bill.
Well, it certainly affects more than just the farm and just rural interests. It affects all of our food system.
Mm-hmm. So whether you live in Northampton, Massachusetts, or whether you live up in Bellingham, Washington, if you're, you know, getting in touch with your representatives and saying, I know that you get a lot of letters on a lot of important things, but I want you to know that as a person who appreciates, you know, where my food comes from, I want you to take a stronger stance in the food bill, because most of the voices, as you were saying, Oren, are coming from the states that do a lot of food production and commodity food production. So that dictates the conversation. So city dwellers or urban dwellers have to let their constituents know, their representatives know, that it's important that they represent them in this farm bill.
Right. And if some of our listeners are interested in learning more about this, I encourage them to read my book. I have a whole section in the book that helps people understand exactly the kinds of policies that you would want to put in place to start moving our system toward a more healthy direction.
Yes, a fantastic book, lots of amazing thoughts, and very positive, of really not so much describing what's broken, even though the book is placing the issues in that, or it's placed in that context, but really about the possibility of how to heal it, and a great resource guide as well.
And so, Oren, what does a fair food system look like?
When I think of a fair food system, I think of a food system that has four attributes. It's food that's healthy, produces food that's healthy for our bodies, food that's green, environmentally friendly, food that's fair, means nobody's getting exploited in this system, from production to processing to distribution, and it's affordable food that everybody has access to. Healthy, green, fair, and affordable food in a system that is more diverse, a system that makes sure we're protecting the environment and not destroying it, and a system that that creates economic viability for many more producers, many more processors. You know, we have opportunities for all kinds of new businesses, all kinds of new job creation as we localize and regionalize our food system.
Mm-hmm. And then often we do hear that argument from our listeners, or that question is kind of floating out there in terms of productivity. Can a localized food system, you know, feed the world? And I know that question came up a few days ago at an event with you, one of your book signings that you're now on tour with, and with your new book, Fair Food. And of course, the answer is, if we measure productivity just in terms of quantity of bushels per acre, how it has been done in the 70s and 80s, a large farm will always be able to produce more output. If we look at productivity and take all the parts into consideration, meaning all the inputs that were needed to create that much food, actually the smaller the farm, the more productive it gets. And that's all backed up by U.S. governmental studies. So productivity is a tricky one if you really look at the true productivity of a small farm and the small economy and the local jobs that you were just mentioned. The smaller the farm and the more local the food, the better actually and the stronger the food system is.
Well, you know, Helga, the point that I make in the book is that it doesn't need to be one or the other. It's not an either or here. That we have room enough in our food system for many approaches. The issue is that right now about 98% of our food system is a system based on highly globalized, highly chemicalized, highly concentrated type of food system, and about 2% is functioning along the lines of a fair food system. That's way out of balance.
Yes.
I was saying that, you know, if in my lifetime we could see it jump from 2% to 20% of a food system functioning in alignment with those kind of values, it would change the landscape.
So, Oren, when I hear you say this about the 2%, and what it makes me wonder is, all my life for 30 years I've been in the organic food industry and the local food initiatives. But one of the things as I've always heard is if we try to go to a more regionalized food system, we won't be able to feed America. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that that is more based on opinion than evidence.
Okay.
And everybody has a right to their opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But evidence that I've seen would lead me to believe that we have much more room. We can go much closer to a 20% figure and still be producing abundant food for everybody who needs it. I mean, you know, one thing to think about, there's pretty good research that shows us that from the farm field to consumption, we may be wasting up to 40% of our food.
Which, Helga, you've brought up several times in our show.
Yes. All we have to do is think about conservation. And you've got 40% more than you have right now.
Yeah, there are nonprofits such as Marin Organic in Marin County who just uses that food that you're mentioning. That in Marin, it's about 20-25% after the harvest, food with slight cosmetic blemishes or just, you know, kind of cosmetically challenged, a little bit too big, a little bit crooked, as we all are cosmetically challenged in one way or another. So that food usually gets plowed under. In Marin County, that is being harvested by children as part of place-based education and then brought to schools. So without a dollar more in the school's budget, Marin Organic is able to, you know, address 10,000 children every week just by using that surplus food or in that you're mentioning, and that's true for the entire country. So we're wasting too much. I think the notion of the U.S. has to feed the world is inherently wrong. We have to empower communities everywhere around the globe to be food independent, to have their own local food systems, wherever they may be. And if you look at hunger statistics, and Oren, we talked about that, hunger has not changed in the last 30 years, even though the productivity, you know, quote unquote, has gone up, up, up. And we have more people now being food dependent and in hunger around the world. So it's not working the way we're doing it,
It's a broken system, and we have to get on with the job of fixing it, of redesigning our food system.
Yes, and that brings us to your book. We're talking with Oren Hesterman, Dr. Oren Hesterman, the CEO and president of the Fair Food Network, who's now on tour with his brand new book, Fair Food. It's really a solution guide. It's really based on what's possible and how we can add to being a conscious eater to become a concerned and engaged citizen, really action-driven. And we want to talk about that more, Oren. What can people do? There are many easy ways of getting more involved in your food system. Mark, you just mentioned be in touch with your representative. That's one important one. I think some states, California's last state election had 19% voter turnout. That's not enough to change things. But they are really daily acts that you're describing in your book, Oren, that people can do to support a new direction where we can take this food system. All that when we come back to that interview with you.
Mm-hmm. But now we get to talk to Chef Sita, and she's going to tell us what to do with the plums that I was telling you about earlier in the show. And this is Chef Sita and her Holistic Bites.
Thanks so much, Mark. Well, I am a really big fan of low maintenance fruit, which is fruit that you can just, you know, grab out of your basket and take with you to work or pack in your kids' lunch bag. Mm-hmm. And after so many months of apples and oranges, I'm really excited to welcome plum season with open arms because it's another one of those great low maintenance fruits. So just as Mark was saying, there are so many different varieties of plums. One of my favorites is called the elephant heart plum. Have you guys had
an
elephant? Oh my God. Yeah, and it's different because I think it's a little bit softer, a little bit sweeter and juicier, and it's got this gorgeous deep red color when you bite into it. So I'm so excited about plum season, and they're so good for you. I mean, plums are rich in vitamin C. They also have a lot of your B vitamins. And I talk a lot about the phytonutrients, which offer you so much in terms of nutritional benefit other than just your vitamins and minerals. So the way that I identify usually the health benefits of a food has to do with its color. And when you look at the plums that are at that deep purple, blue, reddish color, they have a lot of antioxidants. And I talk about this with other fruits like your blackberries, your blueberries, and grapes. So plums are rich in antioxidants. And they also have a specific phytonutrient called chlorogenic acid. And chlorogenic acid, in addition to being an antioxidant, also helps to inhibit tumor activity. So it's anti-carcinogenic as well. And they have found that it can help in the prevention of type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. So again, the beauty of whole foods, just like Dr. Oren Hesterman is talking about, this is what's going to heal us. So moving on to how delicious these foods are in addition to being good for you. If you're like me, it's really difficult for me to like not bite into the plum as soon as I buy it, even if it's not totally ripe yet. It's just like calling my name from the bowl, which is, I'm the same way. I can't wait. I'm so excited about it.
I do it in the store.
I love it. I'm going to go shopping with you so people don't look at me funny when I do that.
There you go.
So if you are like me in that respect and you tend to start nibbling on your plums before they get really sweet, that's totally fine. If a plum is a little bit on the tart side, which I'm a big fan of your sweet sour fruits, if it's a little bit on the tart side, it has a lot to offer in terms of strengthening your digestive system. And plums, we talk about these Japanese plums that you were mentioning earlier, have been used for a long time for therapeutic benefit as far as your digestive system is concerned. In Japan, they pickle umeboshi plums. Umeboshi is what they're called. And they're really great at strengthening your digestive system and easing stomach aches. So you can buy these umeboshi plums. You can also buy umeboshi plum vinegar. And really great for helping with digestive discomfort. So super good for you. Now, that isn't the kind of plum that you necessarily want to be indulging in because they're really, really salty and a little bit on the sour side. So if you go to the plums that you're going to find coming up this season in your market, you're going to wonder what you're going to do with them. And this weekend, 4th of July weekend, we're all celebrating. And the things that you tend to see if you go to a barbecue are blueberry pie, strawberry shortcake. And those are great, red, white, and blue, all for that. But why don't you surprise your friends with something that's a little bit more exotic? Stone fruit is really exotic. And it makes people feel, I talked about this when we did cherries, it makes people feel really precious because it takes a little bit more work than just rinsing a basket of blueberries. You've got to go through and remove those pits. So plums are really delicious baked in pies and tarts. And one of my favorite ways, I love galettes. If you've never had a galette, it's essentially just like a freeform pie where you take the dough, you fill all of your fruit in it, and then you fold the dough over it. So it's a lot more low maintenance. There's a low maintenance thing again than your traditional pie would be. So what you do with these plums is you're going to want to blanch them first because their skin is kind of the most sour part about it, and it's a little bit tougher to eat, so it's not quite as pleasant if you're going to put it in a pie or a galette. So get a pot of boiling water going and score the bottom of your plums with an X, and then drop the plums in the boiling water for about 30 seconds. Then pull them out and dunk them in some ice water so that they can be cool enough to handle. And then it's really easy to pull off the skin, get rid of that super sour and slightly more fibrous bit, and then slice wedges out of your plums. Then you can put that in the center of your pie dough and top it with a drizzle of maple syrup and some really cold coconut oil, which is great for you. I talk a lot about my love of coconut and all things wonderful about the health benefits of coconut. So some coconut oil and some orange zest. And then take that dough, fold it over your plums, and bake it. And when it comes out, when your crust is done cooking, you can top it with some chopped almonds. One of the things I like about almonds and plums together, they're actually in the same family. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of research, and really just like research with our taste buds, that if you pair foods together that naturally are part of the same family, they complement each other really beautifully. So this galette with a little bit of orange zest topped with some toasted chopped almonds is a really nice surprise at your backyard barbecue. And another thing you can do, if you're not having people over to celebrate 4th of July, but you're going to get out and enjoy the long weekend, what I like to do with my friends and family when they come to visit on long weekends are go to state parks. And so I always pack us a picnic to enjoy while we're enjoying those spectacular views. And sandwiches travel really well, but you don't have to do peanut butter and jelly over and over again. Why don't you do a really elegant savory plum tartine? So what you can do is take your baguette, slice it in half, put some really floral fragrant honey as just a really light thin spread over it. Top it with dolce latte cheese. Have any of you guys had that before? Dolce latte? It's a type of blue cheese that's really mild. So for people who don't like blue, I find that they do get excited about dolce latte because it's really mild. It's very creamy, and it's a little bit on the sweet side. So it goes nicely with these plums that are sweet and sour. So you've got a little bit of honey, some dolce latte cheese, some sliced fresh plum, and top it with some pea shoots or sunflower sprouts, some kind of light, tender green. And then you've got a nice snack to take, dine al fresco on top of your car at the state park. It's a really nice surprise, and I think it's an elegant way to enjoy plums in lots of different varieties.
Wow, that'd be a first. That'd be a first date meal for me.
Oh, please take me.
Honey, plums. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I'm salivating, and all that and more on Natural Chef Sita's blog. All the recipes in detail on our Facebook page, an Organic Conversation Facebook. Check it out. Wow. I don't know which one to do first, but that's insane. Yes. And if you use a gluten-free dough, you can have a gluten-free galette.
Absolutely.
I think that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to try that.
Ooh, maybe
weekend.
That's the one I'll put up there is gluten-free pastry.
Yes,
dough.
The holistic
you,
bite
Helga.
With Chef Sita. Thank you, Sita. That was awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
Very inspiring. Who knew? Plums. Go plums. We're talking about the food system today. Dr. Oren B. Hesterman, the author of his new book, Fair Food, is with us in the studio from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and we will look at the actions we can all take. Authors such as Michael Pollan, Eric Schlosser, and Anna LaPay have helped create a new level of awareness and eco-literacy around the issue of food and food production and what's broken about the current food system and how we can steer it into a new direction, into a more sustainable future for all of us, is the topic of this show, An Organic Conversation. I'm Helga Hilberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we'll be diving into fair food and the daily actions we can do with Oren here in the studio when we come back right after the break. Stay tuned.
How long do I have to wait for the sun to shine again?
Frye Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Frye never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Frye organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Frye Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines, without added sulfites, available at grocery stores and online at fryewine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Produce is ever-changing, seasons coming and going. At Earls Organic, we have been sourcing solely organic produce for over 20 years. Since 1988, Earls Organic Produce has been establishing strong relationships with growers and developing a deep understanding of the seasons, so you can offer the most delicious organic produce to your customers, staff, and clients year-round. For organic produce, visit Earls Organic Produce at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Sungevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Sungevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Hi, my name is Abby Leeson, and I am the co-founder of The Ginger People. You can find our products in natural food stores near you, from delicious ginger drinks, sauces, spreads, ginger chews, baked goods, to skincare products. We love ginger. It's what we do. Add the benefits of ginger to your life, and you get that little kick, too. I am Abby Leeson, and I'm with The Ginger People. For inspiration around ginger, go to gingerpeople.com. That's gingerpeople.com.
And we're back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Helberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And with us in the studio from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Dr. Oren Hesterman, a food systems expert for the last
35 years. I mean, since I was an organic farmer
it's
in
Santa Cruz. It's literally your life, right? It's literally your
life. This is what I've spent my life doing.
And lucky us that you have. With his new book, Fair Food, really a solutions guide to how we can heal the current food system. We talked about what's broken. We talked about how we got here. And your book, a refreshing new look at what engaged citizens can do or how we can become engaged citizens. What are some of the things you see as the most important or the easiest to do other than being a conscious eater as we all eat every day and with that shaping the food system, all of us, several times a day throughout the country?
Right, Helga, what I say is the most important single transformation we need to do is make the shift from conscious consumer to engaged citizen. So what do I mean by that? I mean that go beyond. Certainly take care of what goes into your refrigerator and how you're eating, absolutely. But we have to go beyond that if we're going to change this system. We have to start thinking about not just how we are accessing, our own families accessing great food at farmers markets, but how to support organizations and programs like our Double Up Food Bucks project, where we're incentivizing low-income consumers and families to come to farmers markets.
Tell us more about that. What is that?
That's a program where anybody at any participating farmers markets, we're doing it in Michigan, but it's now spreading across the country, comes to a farmers market with their food stamp card. For every $20 they spend at the farmers market of their federal food assistance money, they get an additional $20 to spend on locally grown produce at that market.
Which is already, it's already awesome that at this point you can actually bring food stamps to the farmers market.
Yes.
5 years ago, that was
right.
A novelty.
Right.
The farmers market too would accept that.
And it's having a huge impact.
But you're going beyond. You're doubling whatever. Who's paying for that? Where's
right
the
now,
money coming
right
from?
Now we have 26 different foundations supporting this project throughout the state of Michigan. But our plan is to use this as a statewide demonstration of the feasibility and effectiveness of incentives and include that in the conversation about the next farm bill. What many people don't understand about our farm policy is that out of every dollar we spend, out of every federal dollar we spend at USDA and through the farm bill, 75 cents of that is going to food assistance, is going to food stamps. It's a huge flow of resources that we can be using more effectively to help people, to encourage people to eat healthier food while supporting local agriculture at the same time. And we're demonstrating that.
So you're saying out of every dollar, 75 cents out of the farm bill, which is $60 billion a year, every 5 years, about $300 billion over the five-year course, 75% of that entire budget, which is it's about $300 billion, $280 billion goes to subsidies of some form.
Is going specifically to food assistance, to what used to be called food stamps. We now call it SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition
amazing.
Assistance Program. Yeah, I detail this in my book, in you know, with charts and graphs and so forth. So you know, that's one thing we can do, but we don't have to stop there. What I say is engage wherever you live, work, play, or worship. Every institution that we're interacting with spends money on food, whether it's being concerned about how your youngsters are getting fed in their schools. Mm-hmm. That's a place where you can start making a difference with other parents. If you're a college student and you care about it, join in with the Real Food Challenge, trying to shift 20% of all purchases from college and university food services.
Or the cafeteria.
Absolutely. They're out to change $1 billion of food purchasing to local, regional, sustainable sources. You can join in with this organization that's up and running.
That's fantastic.
To my book and find the website. You find the leaders of that organization in every state. If you work in the healthcare industry, start encouraging your organization, like Kaiser Permanente is starting to do right here in the Bay Area.
We had him on the show a few months ago. Fantastic, fabulous work.
And that's work that can spread and replicate all over the country. And of course, I don't want us to forget public policy. Whether it's at the local level, making sure that small businesses like the food trucks here in San Francisco are able to do business legally, so we can have many more entrepreneurs in the system, whether it's farmland preservation to make sure we're holding on to that precious farmland for the future, or whether it's getting engaged in something like the Farm Bill. Many, many ways to get engaged, many organizations to support with your time and money, and you can find out, you can read all about it in my book.
And there's good work being done everywhere, Seattle, Boston, coast to coast, throughout the country, you really name it, and the creativity is almost endless. You were talking about something in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where there's now Friday morning breakfast.
Yes, kind of shindig.
Is this legal? Can we talk about this on the air?
We can talk about it. Absolutely.
Not that we haven't talked about illegal things on the air, but yeah, we'll try and.
It's legal. It's not a restaurant. It is a home party every Friday morning.
That's right.
You go to the home of great folks, Jeff and Lisa in Ann Arbor. They open it up. 200 people every Friday morning are now coming
for breakfast.
Wow.
For breakfast. Yeah.
Local chefs are now featured. They come and they do the cooking. It's a gathering of local solutionaries on the food system. And when we show up, everybody donates somewhere between $10 and $20. And that money is being used now to help finance the construction of hoop houses or high tunnels on farms all around us in Michigan to extend the growing season, to get more local food in farmers markets, in restaurants, and in grocery stores.
Now, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, so the final question was, what inspires you about this food system? But we kind of got there.
How could you not be inspired?
No, but is that why you're doing it? Does that make you the most hopeful?
I'll tell you what inspires me the most, and it's happening every day as I'm on this book tour, and that is that almost everywhere I go to sign books, to meet people, half the people showing up are age 35 or younger, and these young people are on fire. You know, the cause in my generation when I was that age was the Vietnam War. It galvanized a generation. The cause these days is repairing and fixing our broken food system and taking it back, taking control of the food system back. And young people are on fire about this, and I'm meeting them, and they tell me that my work and writing inspires them, and I tell them right back, hey, I want to tell you what you're doing and your energy is inspiring me.
And taking back this democracy, because it's not one or the other. It's really all of it, taking back the power that we actually have.
Correct. And the food system is a place we can do it, and we can each do it today in many, many ways.
Yes. Oren, can you do me the favor, and us and our listeners, to just not stop working ever?
Well, as you know, Helga, I'm not slowing down.
Good. Yes. It's beyond wonderful to have you. Thank you for this time. Thank you for all your work. Thank you for this book. Again, we are talking about solutions on this show quite a lot, the language of possibility.
And let me just say, if our listeners are interested in meeting me,
yes,
we have a website, fairfoodbook.org. You can go to that website, and we are, I am wandering around this country right now, introducing
book
the book,
yes,
introducing people to it and meeting people. And you can see where I'm going to be and when I'm going to be. And I want to meet people who are actively working in this issue.
fairfoodbook.org, fairfoodbook.org, or fairfoodnetwork.org, which you're the CEO and president of. Thank you for your amazing work.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Yeah. Wow, what a great show.
I'm inspired again.
We could keep this interview going on for hours.
Yes. Wonderful. Thanks,
but
Aaron.
We can't, because we do have a time deadline, and I want to make sure we get to the mailbag this week, Helga. So what's on our listeners' minds this week?
Yes, the mailbag, the weekly update of what our listeners are thinking and writing about and are concerned about and commenting on. And Gina had it in the beginning of the show in the news headlines. Congress bans FDA. Well, the House of Representatives has passed a law that would prohibit the FDA from approving genetically modified fish. genetically modified salmon. And it's now going to the Senate floor. If the Senate passes a similar language, then it goes into law and will be signed into law by the president. The first time ever that Congress is stepping up and regulating FDA or directing FDA in this critical issue around food. Genetically modified salmon would be the first live animal to actually be approved for human consumption. So lots of resistance there, lots of unanswered questions that need to be clarified first, lots of legal issues and health issues that have not been addressed. So good work to step up. And we had several people, we got like, I don't know, 40 people liking this on Facebook. Mm-hmm. We posted the article on Facebook and Organic Conversation Facebook. Check it out. I loved the comment. We got plenty of comments. But Marianne Connor commented, "Didn't they watch all those Japanese horror mega monster movies?" And I thought that was so poignant, because if you look at a GE salmon after 18 months, it almost looks like a blow up puppy. It's the, you know, an 18 months wild regular salmon is about 2 feet, foot and a half, 2 feet, maybe two, a little bit bigger. The GE salmon is 3 times the size. It looks so ridiculously, your mind, you look at it and you recognize that your mind can't even comprehend how any salmon could ever be this big. And then compared to 18 months and 18 months, it's mind blowing. And if people say, oh yeah, there's no issue with that, we don't know what it will do, because, you know, female salmon always look for the biggest guy. And the salmon now, because they don't want it to be, you know, going into nature, because we don't know yet, but it's safe for human consumption, they say. Anyway, they have made that salmon sterile. So if a large salmon was to be released into nature, all the females would think, wow, I want to mate with that guy, but he can't mate. At least he might think he can, but he can't. And what does that do to the salmon population out there in the wild if one escapes? So lots of unanswered questions, but I just love that comment. Didn't they watch all those Japanese horror mega monster movies? Which reminds me of my childhood when 3D was, you know, as fancy as kind of a little plastic thing walking over the TV as a Japanese horror movie. So bad, but so classic.
So you had those in Germany too?
Yeah. Oh yeah, of course. Yes.
And you know,
what about you? What did you fish?
One of the things that I want to get to, make sure we get to, is a new segment that we're adding to the show.
Yes.
And we hear from lots of listeners about our, you know, our food information and about what's in season and stuff. So we've added Chef Sita to the show and what's in season. But now's a new segment that we're adding that we get to and bring our listeners your insights for the week and what you want to talk about. And so now, ready for it? Helga's Organic Moment.
Well, I love the creativity and diversity that our guest today spoke about, and the diversity of this movement. It's so rich and creative, and I'm just in awe about what people think and what they care about and how they react to things. And so I gave an interview about heirlooms just the other day, and it's that time of the year. Restaurants more and more now starting to embrace heirlooms, different varieties, unusual shapes of fruits and vegetables. And you know, did you know there were 7,500 different varieties of tomatoes? There are over 4,000 varieties of potatoes. It's mind-boggling. Every single variety has specific attributes, specific flavors. Some are more drought-resistant. Some are grown in higher altitudes. Some are grown sea level, can be grown in cooler climates, can be grown in hotter climates, have different tastes, flavors, shapes, store better than others. So because of this abundance of character, we are safe throughout the year. Heirlooms are a visual manifestation of the web of life for me, and that we are part of, feeding us, supporting us, hoping that we are supporting it back. So it's actually really a metaphor for society. By definition, an heirloom is true to its seed of value and can be passed down from generation to generation. So I thought, wouldn't it be great if we all were heirlooms? What a metaphor. We can be true to our seed or heart, be of value in this lifetime, and do good. And then we can be assured that our gifts and contributions, just as Oren Hesterman's great book, Fair Food, will be handed down from generations to generations.
Beautiful. That's exactly why we wanted you to have that moment. Thanks, Helga. So that was this week's edition of An Organic Conversation. Thanks for listening.
And An Organic Conversation is a production of the Media Organic Media Network. Associate producer is Gina Vistani. If you missed parts of this show or for any other show, go to iTunes or anorganicconversation.com. We're your hosts, Helga Hellberg.
And Mark Mulcahy.
And we'll be back right here, same place, same time next week. See you then.
Bye-bye. With the time ahead, I live on my year.